You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. This is Jill Najo, and I'm sitting in for Larry today. Our next guest is the daughter of an adventurous outdoorsman who explored the North Woods in the early 20th century. She's sharing his remarkably detailed journals with us in a beautiful new book. It's called Border Country, The North Woods Canoe Journal of Howard Green, 1906 to 1916. And Martha Green Phillips is in our Eau Claire studios, and she'll be with us shortly. Have you been fortunate enough to have artifacts from the outdoor adventures of someone in your family? What are your memories of camping with your family? I'm sure we all have lots of those. Join the conversation and share those with us. Give us a call, the number 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and you can always post comments and questions on our Facebook page. And if you can, share some old camping or canoeing photos. That would be really fun. Martha, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, good morning. I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad it worked out on your trip back from the Twin Cities to Madison area. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about your father? He seemed like a really remarkable man. What are your earliest memories of Howard Green?
My earliest memories, of course, as a small child and just having a comforting parent. As I got a little older, I became aware of his journals and his life before I came along, and that is what the subject of the book.
So they were part of your life, obviously, from little on, and it seems like nature has been a really important part of your family. In the book, you have a picture of your grandfather's fossil collection.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us about what nature meant to your family and still does, I'm assuming?
Yes. I will start back with my grandfather, Thomas Green, in Milwaukee, who was one of the Victorian amateur naturalists. And he started into collecting fossils as a way of relaxing from his work in his business. And he got so into it that he developed probably the largest collection of Silurian fossils in the state, and even traded specimens with Increase Lapham. So that was a big part of my father's growing up in Milwaukee.
Sure. So that probably then inspired him. Besides these trips, was he into other things like that before the trips?
Well, he enjoyed landscaping. He enjoyed being in the outdoors. He knew geology reasonably well, but he was just an all-around outdoorsman and collected friends who were equally so. On these trips that he made up into the North Woods, he had two or three friends that always went along. One was a gynecologist, obstetrician in Milwaukee, and Doc was a plant, flora, fauna, everything nature collector, and seemed to know a lot about medicinal herbs and things like that. Another one of his friends was a real expert in geology and in the rock structures they came across. So all of his friends had similar leanings, and together they made a pretty educated group.
It sounds like it. Now, the book has just come out, correct?
Correct.
It is absolutely gorgeous, I have to tell you. And I'm thinking, oh, this would be a perfect gift for the person on my holiday list who likes the outdoors, because it really is beautifully done. Tell us about what's in the book and why you decided that you wanted to put these journals all together.
Okay. I'd like to start with just a little bit of the history of the journals, which is my dad, on many trips, many annual trips, kept detailed notes in camp. And he also took a large format camera and old Graflex along. And he took over a series of 10 years, over 800 pictures on these trips. These are large format, sort of Curtis-style photos of that vintage.
Glass plates, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And when he returned to Milwaukee at the end of each trip, he would type up the notes in triplicate with carbons, old style.
Amazing.
And he would mount photographs from the trips in the journals, and he made up handmade journals, leather-bound journals, for each member of the camping party every year. After my mother died, I inherited my dad's journals from all those trips. And it just seemed to me that they ought to be shared. I knew I was going to donate them to the Wisconsin Historical Society, but it just seemed wrong that they would go and sit on a shelf until some grad student discovered them in 30 years and had no idea who these people were.
Right.
So that sort of grew into the idea of writing a book about the journals, because I felt that I was in a good position to give the background. I didn't know all the people in the journals, but I knew of all the people in the journals and had contacts in the family of people who had more knowledge. So I was in a good position to write the background information.
So what did you have to do to actually prepare to put these into a book format?
Well, I began with doing book proposals, which would include perhaps condensed versions of each year's journals and a little bit of background information. And then I had the good fortune of running into the people at the University of Minnesota Press who were so excited about the journals that they decided to print 6 of the 8 verbatim.
Oh,
I ended up condensing only 2 of the journals, which mm-hmm. were to some degree outliers in the series anyway. And so the University of Minnesota jumped into this, and we've come up with a book that looks just like the antique journals, the archival journals. It has a black leather-like cover, gold-stamped title, which is exactly what the other journals look like, the originals. And the book includes, as I say, 6 of the 8 journals verbatim with, you know, funny comments, good comments, some irreverent use of language and other things.
Right, right.
2 journals condensed somewhat and edited, and my notes on who the people were, what I learned about why they went where they went, and things like that that were not in my dad's original journals. And so I composed a field guide that kind of gives all that description, which will, I think, enrich the reader's experience.
I was just going to say that. I thought it made it just that little extra that made it just so more personal, and it was very enjoyable reading.
Well, I'm
that.
Happy for that result.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So you introduce each journal with a little background, and then it's pretty much up to your dad, right?
It is, yes. Mm-hmm. It's a mixture. It's my book and that I added to it and brought forth these journals so that they could be published. Mm-hmm. But it's my dad's book still.
Right.
It's his writing and his wit and his photos. So it's sort of a combination effort here.
And why don't you tell us why he started writing? Because it was basically because his oldest son couldn't come
yes.
on the trip, right?
Yeah. The first trip he took in 1906, he wanted to take his sons out into the woods. The other reason for his trip was he finally had his business in good enough shape that he could leave it in care of a trusted person in the office mm-hmm. and get away for a few weeks. But he was ready to get out of Milwaukee, get his sons out into the outdoors. Keep in mind, this is the Teddy Roosevelt era when being outdoors and roughing it was, you know, a definite ideal. Mm-hmm. But he wanted to get his sons out of Milwaukee and get them out in the world. So he, with a couple of friends, planned to take a son and his friend out onto the Wisconsin River. The son became quite ill and was in the hospital, and they expected he'd be able to join them part way. So they began the trip, and then it became clear that the son was not going to be able to come along. He had blood poisoning. It had settled in his foot. He couldn't walk well, so he just could not have been doing these trips. So my dad began a series of daily letters to Howard, who was back in Milwaukee in the hospital, and he could post them on logging trains or any other kind of train that was in the area and get them to Milwaukee quickly and get a response back quite quickly, too. So it became a dialogue between Howard and he. And the letters at the end of the trip, he realized, almost made a journal. I don't think he had any conscious plan to make a journal, but he realized he had these letters that described the trip, so he put them together, copied them, and put them in a journal. That first journal did not include photographs, and the photographs from the trip that he took had were separate and have gotten lost over the years.
Oh, mm-hmm.
But that became the beginning of this series of journals. And then starting with his 1907 trip up to on the St. Croix, and then the 1909 on the Presque Isle River up in the UP, 3 trips that ended up in what's now the Boundary Waters in Quetico, and a trip on the Pigeon River, pretty mm-hmm. much round out the series. But on each of those, they became slightly more elaborate journals, slightly more elaborate in terms of numbers of pictures.
And lots of details, which are so interesting, not only yes. about what they did, but about what they saw and who they met. Very, very interesting. We're talking with Martha Green Phillips about her book, Border Country, The Northwoods Canoe Journals of Howard Green, 1906-1916. You know, I think when I first I opened it up, I'm like, oh, gee, why did they stop in 1916? What was the reasons for that?
Well, World War I was the biggest. Mm-hmm. That was the major reason. But also, that was over a 10-year period, and the boys had grown into being college age and going off on their own. So the last trip that he made was actually with a young cousin and some other friends, because his sons and his son's friends had all sort of gone into their own worlds at that point.
Sure. Do you know how the decision to where they were going to go was made?
Each trip, they wanted to get to a more wild and remote place.
Ah.
I think that's the general progression.
Sure.
That didn't hold true 100%.
Mm-hmm.
The Wisconsin was nice. It was fine. Good beginning. But that made them want to do something a little wilder. So when they went up to the St. Croix, they hoped for a little bit more remote area. And they did find that. There was still logging going on. They became part of a logging run on the river. They saw Native American villages and settlements. And so it was a little wilder than the Wisconsin. But in my dad's inimitable style at that time, he said, but there were women there fishing. And that was just a little too tame for him at that point in his life. So they looked for a little wilder country when they went to the Presque Isle up in the Upper Peninsula, which absolutely met all those requirements.
Mm-hmm.
It was a scary and dangerous trip, but they made it.
And do you think, you had mentioned in the book that you thought that that was probably the pinnacle, and that's what all the other trips were trying to reach. Do you think that...
It was a pinnacle in terms of wildness and danger.
I don't know
that it was a pinnacle in terms of otherwise rich experiences that they had, but it all became the bar by which they measured the dangers mm-hmm. they were in.
And now you've gone to visit some of these areas too, haven't you?
I've tried to visit some. I have been on the Presque Isle River, and probably quite a few people in the listening audience have been. They've been up to the Porcupine Mountains.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
And it is a scary river to walk beside. It's just almost a vertical river going down to Lake Superior. And when I have visited there twice, I've thought, why on earth did they pick such a dangerous river? But at the time, there were no guidebooks. There were not even adequate maps of the area. And my dad wrote to two friends who had some knowledge of the Upper Peninsula and said, what do you think about the Presque Isle River? And the first said, oh, I don't think you'd enjoy it. The beginning of it's not that great, and there's a lot of rapids. The second person said, oh, I think it'd be a fine trip. Just go ahead and do it. So they did, and would not have if they'd had more knowledge, I suspect. But they made
happens.
It.
That happens. They did make it.
We've
been talking with Martha Green Phillips about her new book. It's called Border Country, The Northwoods Canoe Journals of Howard Green, 1906 to 1916. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. Please stay with us. We're going to continue our conversation right after the news, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234 or post on our Facebook page. It's The Larry Mueller Show, and we can always find pictures there, too. So please post and let us know what you think about camping and canoeing and having fun with the family. Camping today is certainly different than camping was in the early 1900s, but what hasn't changed is the memories of sharing time with family and friends. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry today. Martha Green Phillips is with us. She is sharing accounts of her father's adventures in the Northwoods. His stories and photos from his detailed journals are now published in a new book, and it's called Border Country, The Northwoods Canoe Journal of Howard Green, 1906 to 1916. Do you think that shared outdoor experiences strengthen family? What's your favorite memory of camping, hiking, or canoeing? We'd like you to be part of our conversation. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Martha, you had talked a little bit earlier about some of the people that went with your dad, but there were others too, right? Your brothers went along?
Correct. My half-brothers each took one of the trips, and some went more often. One was not a very outdoorsy person, I'm afraid. But my half-brothers, Howard and Carl, were regulars, and some of their school friends, which took in the gang, as they called themselves.
Right.
Sometimes was a gang of six, sometimes it was a gang of 8 or 10.
And
counting
they,
the men and the kids and a hired helper.
Okay. And they had a really good time from the sound of it.
I think so.
The details and some of the jokes and some of the things they did. Do you have a favorite story or two that you can share with us?
Oh, wow.
I'm sure there's hundreds, right? Yeah.
Well, one that comes to mind is up on the Presque Isle River, Carl, who was the artist and quite the character. Carl was the fascinating member of the group, and sometimes getting into a little trouble. But Carl got separated from the group around Lake McFarland, which is just on the eastern edge of the Boundary Waters. And they trusted that he would get back okay. They were not ready to send out a search and rescue mission because they knew that Carl would probably take care of it and eventually find a path around the lake and join them. And they were sitting in camp, and they heard this splashing noise, and suddenly Carl emerged on a makeshift raft. He'd been across the lake, found an old log and a board that had some nails in it, and cobbled those together with a rock on the beach and proceeded to paddle it across, kind of like a surfboard.
Sure.
Across the lake, and here he came out of the dark. But the picture of the raft is something. It does not look very seaworthy.
No.
But he got there, and they would have gone out if they'd really been worried about him for long. But, you know, in this day of Last Child in the Woods and that kind of movement, it's striking that these kids had so many experiences in which they were allowed to test themselves, but mm-hmm. still with some nice protections around
right,
them.
Right, right. How old was he when he did that? He looked pretty young.
Yeah, I think he was 9 when he started going on these trips. So he was young.
Yeah, and the pictures of him are...
I'm guessing his mother wanted him out of the house.
Probably.
I think he was a mischievous child, and was probably all too happy for Dad to take him off her hands for a few weeks, because there are a lot of stories about Carl and the family.
And, you know, he looks like that from the pictures that were taken.
Yeah.
He just has that twinkle. And, you know, talking about those pictures, your father did such a beautiful job of just capturing what was going on. Just, you know, they're beautiful pictures.
He was an excellent photographer, mm-hmm. which I, of course, always believed because I was his daughter.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
But it was nice to get the validation of starting mm-hmm. to show these journals to different people, historians and people around the state and the region. And they said, wow, those are great pictures. And it's like, yeah, I thought so too.
You know?
Well, I had one experience with that was really quite something. And in the beginning, I was showing these journals to a few people to say, what do you think? Do you think I've got the are these special? Do I have the makings of a book?
Uh-huh.
And I showed them to a historian up at Voyageurs National Park. And she was almost in tears because some of my dad's pictures labeled things that they had been researching for park history and did not know. They had guesses, but there was nothing to document.
Well, it is a treasure trove.
And so, you know, not only are they beautiful, but they've fulfilled a historical need that none of us anticipated.
Well, what I liked about them was that we see so seldom people being people in photos that are that old. They tend to be staged, and, you know, everyone is very still, and you know, there's some blurs in some of these photos because people are moving, and it just makes them seem more real.
Yes, and my dad did have a great sense of humor, so he liked catching a few candid shots here and there. Some of them are just so funny to look at. One of the things that comes to mind is there's a picture on the Presque Isle that just looks like a group of men sitting around a campfire with a blanket in front of them. But if you read the narrative, you learn that they were just soaking wet through most of that trip because there were no portage trails. They had to walk the canoes through the rapids. And everything was soaking wet, including their precious tobacco, their pipe tobacco. And of course, all the men had their own brands and didn't want to, you know, give up their tobacco. But they pooled all their remaining tobacco, put it on a blanket, and held it over the fire so they could dry out their pipe tobacco so they could use it.
And there's just so many stories like that that it just really makes good reading.
I think so.
Yeah, yes. I think anybody that, you know, likes the deer camp this time of year, they can relate
exactly.
to a lot of out of those stories. You know, talking about those pictures that your dad took, he did take a lot of beautiful photos of Native families. And again, they're so different because we see them, you know, how they were living at the time.
Yes, I think they're a little more candid than, mm-hmm. say, the Curtis photos, which are wonderful,
mm-hmm.
you know, or the Bennett photos done
right,
up at Wisconsin
right.
Dells in the same era.
Mm-hmm.
They're not entirely 100% pure candid in that the Native Americans did want some form of payment to allow for pictures.
Right.
So he usually gave tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were okay about having their pictures taken.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And I know there was a couple of disclaimers in the book regarding some of the language, which, you know,
yes.
back in the day. Why don't you talk a little bit about your decision to keep the language in?
Well, that was a tough call. Mm-hmm. But since these are just original archival kinds of accounts, we opted to keep the language in that he used. And there was a lot of soul searching about that. But it just seemed consistent, and that if we changed that, we changed the historical document. So we added a lot of notes, you know, about the era and about the use of the language. And the bottom line is, for me at least, and I think this worked for the press as well, this was Teddy Roosevelt's era. And
mm-hmm.
Teddy Roosevelt was given to saying things like, the only good Indian's a dead Indian. I mean, just horrible things.
Yeah.
So that was the time. Compare it to many in the population. The group was pretty respectful. But their language sounds harsh to us now,
mm-hmm.
using
yeah.
the word squaw, using the word buck, mm-hmm. you know.
But it is a historical document in that it is exactly the way it was done.
Yes, and I think in all cases we noted and labeled it because we just don't want someone not reading the intro
sure.
and finding out or thinking that we think this is fine.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
not.
Yep.
But I'm glad. I think I'm happy we kept it in because it's real.
Yes, right. We have a caller. Dave in Augusta has something he'd like to share with us. Hi, Dave.
Oh, good afternoon. Hearing the stories, which I enjoy a lot, it reminds me of camping with my father. We didn't have a tent. We would go to a remote lake in Adams County, and we'd camp. We'd put the sleeping bags in the back of his station wagon and pull the seats down. This is in the late 60s, early 70s. And he'd bring a little grill right there. We'd make the best breakfast in the morning, you know, and it was just a great time. For $2, you got the campsite per night, plus an old wooden rowboat called Danny. And we got a set of oars. And I want to share a funny little piece of information with that. It would get hot during the July nights there. Of course, we'd roll the windows down, but the mosquitoes would come in. So he got some old window screens, and he got some tape from a guy he worked with. And this guy he worked with swore that it was the best tape around. It would hold up. Well, halfway through the night, the tape let loose. The mosquitoes came in, and we laugh about it now. I mean, I laugh about it now. Dad's gone, but it was just great memories. Just
mm-hmm.
great memories for just $2 or $3 a day. It was just wonderful. So thank you for your stories.
Well, thank you for sharing that,
yeah.
Dave. You know, did your brothers talk about these excursions a lot when you were...
No, they didn't that much when
okay.
I was young. I think if I'd been older and asked the right questions, I would have gotten
yeah,
those answers,
right.
but there was a big age difference.
Right.
Dave's story, though, does take me to something in the book, which is that they were traveling with big old canvas tents that had neither mosquito netting nor sewn in floors.
Right.
So not only were they heavy to carry and hard to set up, but they were basically a rain shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So many nights they did what they called bivouac camping, which was just taking their bedroll and sleeping on the rocks. And at first I was like, why do they sleep outside all the time? But sleeping in a tent or a station wagon with the windows open and no screens is just the perfect haven for mosquitoes. So by sleeping outdoors and in the open air, the breeze would keep some of the mosquitoes away.
Mm-hmm. They must have learned a lot of those things as they were going.
I think so.
Yeah. Yes. Now, what did they actually have to bring in with them for, I mean, they were gone for weeks at a time.
They were. Mm-hmm. They took all their supplies and all the things to make food, all the things to repair things.
Uh-huh.
Their one trip, they went in to what's now the Quetico and Boundary Waters from Canada. And because they went in through Canada from Atikokan, they had to have a list for customs of all the things they were taking along.
Wow.
I'm so thankful they had to make that list mm-hmm. because it contained things I never would have guessed. They carried a pound of white lead. They carried shellac. They carried a lot of tools for fixing the canvas canoes because they were always getting scratched and ripped and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were definitely not Kevlar bounce-off-the-rocks canoes.
No.
But they also carried huge amounts of food. They carried for a 3 to 4 week trip, for example, 30 pounds of bacon, 2 cans of powdered eggs, 2 cans of powdered milk, 50 pounds of oleo, 5 pounds of salt pork, 4 pounds of tea, 3 pounds of coffee, 3 pounds of baking powder. They were baking their own bread in camp whenever they would stop a few days and do that. 5 pounds of raisins, 30 pounds of cornmeal. I mean, just phenomenal amounts of food and weight to carry.
Mm-hmm.
But if you didn't have freeze-dried foods and you had no prepared foods, as we do now, mm-hmm. you'd be taking these amounts. They usually carried 50 to 100 pounds of flour.
Oh, yeah. How was that transported then? On the backs?
They portaged it from place to place.
Okay.
They took a lot of things in heavy wooden crates, which I think was the best way to, the safest way to carry this. They also had large duffel bags for the softer things, but the canned goods and things went in these boxes. And they all portage, and they all carry them. They did have some help along on these trips. They hired a cook and a man about camp.
Okay.
These were not guides. These were not outfitters. The men did all that themselves. But they were people to help out in camp and help carry and help with the cooking. They were usually loggers who were laid off for the summer. So they were not, it was not like going up to Ely and hiring an outfitter who
right.
would say, this is what you need to take, and here's your maps, and here's your guidebooks. The men had no idea where they were going or what they were getting into, the hired people.
They must have had to do a lot of preparation before they took off.
They did weeks before they left Milwaukee. Getting their equipment ready, shipping it by rail to the closest place that they could get it.
Mm-hmm.
And train travel was, there was a much wider network of trains then.
Right.
So they could get pretty close to a wilderness spot on a train. And the food prep, they ordered it from various places, ship it up there. And sometimes it all arrived and sometimes it didn't. They sometimes had to wait a day or two for a lost canoe to get into camp before they could take off.
So of all of these different trips, was there one that you found to be, in the whole, more interesting for you?
Oh, my. That's a difficult question. I think that each trip had its character. I can say pretty clearly that for most people that pick up this book, they get fixed on the Dawson Trail and the Rainy Lake trips because they are in the Quetico Boundary Waters and people know that area.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were so rich in terms of visiting native villages, seeing petroglyphs, seeing, beautiful waterfalls, dams left over from logging days, sunken steamers left over from efforts to get into these remote lakes. I think the history is richest in those journals, and those are the ones that people say, oh, that was my favorite.
Yes.
I have another slight favorite, which is the Pigeon River Journal, which is a smaller trip. They sort of base camped at a logging camp, but they met a very interesting immigrant man there who was such a colorful character that he became pretty much the subject of their book, of that journal. And that is interesting just from the human interest story aspect.
There are lots of interesting aspects for this whole book.
There are.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Kent in Pulaski who has a story she wants to share with us. Hi, Kent.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. What story would you like to share?
Well, I was just going to tell you that it always comes up to me. My older brother, my oldest brother, I'm 55 now, he's in 70. And he used to take me camping all the time. And we ended up at Donfield State Park, maybe 72 or so. And we camped by a little creek, a little stream, and then we went fishing. We caught fish, and then we walked down this valley. And, man, it was hot, and there were deer flies everywhere. And we went to this big pond, and my brother's like, man, he takes his shirt off and just dives right in. And he comes up, and I'm like, hey, where's your glasses? And then there we were. And I was just like, man, I was pretty fun, though. But, yeah, we used to go up. He used to take me when he had time and stuff, you know.
Okay, well, thanks for telling us about that, Kent. There was a lot of swimming that went on in your father's journals, too, wasn't there?
There was, yes.
They had a good time. we got another call coming in from David in Fort Atkinson. Hi, David.
Hi. This is really interesting because I was born and raised up near Marquette, Michigan, in Upper Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Fort Atkinson now, but... And I'm 65, so this goes back to the mid to late 60s. But every summer vacation, my cousins would come from town. We lived out in the country. And when we, during summer vacation, we would just go out in the woods and run around like wild kids. We were 12, 13 years old. We'd just take a sleeping bag if we had it, and then we'd go out with a fishing pole. And my mother would always give us a can of beans. She'd say, well, if in case you starve, don't just starve to death with this P-38 opener thing. Well, anyway, we would be out there for like 2 days in the woods. We didn't know where the heck we were. We were just wild boys and my cousins. And we would go fish. We actually caught fish in the Escanaba River, and we would hook them up, and we'd have a little tan. But we ran into this older gentleman one time right on the Escanaba River fishing, and he seemed like such a nice guy. He had the waders. He had all the gear. You know, we didn't have anything other than a pole and maybe a pocket knife. But he had this beautiful tent, and I said, boy, I said, he said, well, you boys have a tent or anything you sleep in? I said, oh, we just kind of sleep under the stars. And after we helped him clean out a few fish and whatever, and he says, you guys really like that tent? It was a big tent, like a 8-man tent. It was just him. I said, sure. He said, would you like that tent?
I said,
boy, that would be, you know, we were like 13, 14. We couldn't imagine that would be like sleeping on 5-star, you know, 5-star hotel. And we found out later that that was the Judge Bolter that wrote Anatomy of a Murder and where that movie was up in Marquette.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Talked about later, which passed away like in 70 or 71 or something. But nice. We didn't know who he was. We were just there just as wild boys, just kind of, you know, we respected him as an older gentleman fishing. We just talked fish.
Oh, what a great story, David. Thanks for sharing that one with us. You just never know who you're going to run into.
No.
And let's go to Michael in Black River Falls. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to call and thank the author for this book. I ran across it in a bookstore and purchased it, and I felt like I found gold. This is what every young man, I think anyway, dreams of doing, and I think that these boys especially were very fortunate to be able to do that. And I'm still reading it, and having canoed some of the same waters, it's really a lot of fun to read.
I'm so glad you found it and are enjoying it. What is your favorite part so far?
Well, I guess I like all the lists, too, because when you read them, I mean, there's just so much that they took along, and I obviously there was a lot of planning and, you know, the resupply. And,
yes,
of course, overcoming hardships as you meet them, you know. And I just think, you know, when you can go on a trip like that and overcome hardships, it helps you other parts of your life. And I think those boys were very fortunate.
I agree. And I'm jealous myself.
Yeah, I'll bet you are. Well, you know, he was talking about finding that in a bookstore. And Martha, you've got an actual book reading and signing coming up next week, right? In a bookstore.
Yes. I'm in Milwaukee at Boswell Books next week.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have some other book readings coming up over the winter after Christmas. Not all are scheduled yet, but I will be in Baraboo at the Village Booksmith in January. And plan to just keep having these scattered around the southern area this winter.
Sure.
Next summer, I plan to be in Ely, Grand Marais, you know, and hit the northern section when there are more tourists out, to appreciate them.
And easier traveling, usually.
Well,
thank you so much for sharing your father's journals and stories with us, Martha. It really is a wonderful book, and it would be a great holiday gift for almost anybody, really. We've been talking with Martha Green Phillips about her book, Border Country, The Northwoods Canoe Journals of Howard Green, 1906 to 1916. Thanks to Michelle Johnson, our executive producer and on-air producer today, and to Dave Potraz for technical direction. Join us tomorrow. Jim Ward's going to be back with us to help you with your vehicle maintenance questions and remind us how to jumpstart our batteries. It's that time of year. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. We want to thank you very much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Stay with us, because there's always more to come.